We are talking this morning with David Suzuki. He is co-author of the new book, Good News for a Change, How Everyday People Are Helping the Planet. David, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Let me start out and ask you, what is the motivation for writing?
Well, you know, I've been involved in what's called the environmental movement since 1962 when Rachel Carson published a book called Silent Spring. And that really was the catalyst that shot off the environmental movement. People don't understand that in 1962, there were no departments of the environment in any government anywhere on the planet. It was really her book that got the environmental concerns off the ground. And ever since then, I think environmentalists are seen as people that are always saying, you know, the sky is falling, species are going extinct, the air is polluted, forests are vanishing, and I think we're perceived as being doctors of doom and gloom. We're always spreading this depressing story. For me, about 15 years ago, I started getting a lot of people that were saying to me, listen, Suzuki, I've heard your message. I agree with you. We're in trouble. But what can I do? What's the point of telling me this if I don't know that there are any alternatives? And I realized for most people, they're busy. They pay attention to the air and the water and all of that. But they don't really have time to try to find out, are there any alternatives or solutions? So I set up a foundation, which has come to be called the David Suzuki Foundation. And we say, we're looking for solutions to our environmental problems. And we want to communicate those to the public. But about 5 years ago, I decided, I think I need to write a book that really documents whether or not there are individuals, companies, organizations, governments that are really getting us onto a different path, that are looking at the world in a different way and getting us towards what might be a more sustainable future. Now, you know, it's one thing to pick up litter and try to recycle a few things. Of course, that's got to be done, but that's really the bare beginning. There are some really fundamental shifts in the way we do things. When I started doing the research with Holly Dressel 5 years ago, I said to Holly, I hope we can find enough examples to fill a book. I thought maybe it was going to be one thin book. To my amazement, within a few months, it was clear we could have probably written 6 or 7 books. So the good news is there's lots of good news out there, and it's not just in rich countries like ours. You find it in India, in Brazil, even in Africa. There are things going on at the grassroots level. There are also small companies, but big companies. There are governments, even state governments in the States, that are doing bits and pieces of the right thing. So I hope that the book is widely read, because it really is inspiring to realize there are solutions out there and to see how many people in so many different ways are doing the right thing.
You mentioned early on in your book that there's certain qualities that all these different solutions that you came upon share. Could you tell us what those are?
Well, there are a number of qualities. One of them is these usually are very locally based. That is, they're groups or organizations or even governments that are committed to a local area. They're where people are looking beyond the immediate bottom line of whether or not they're going to get reelected or whether or not their quarterly report is going to be good for the company. They're looking much further down the line. And they begin with an understanding that our ability to live long, healthy lives is dependent on the state of other species, plants and animals, and ecosystems around us. So it begins with a deep understanding of caring about the environment and looking longer term. My foundation, for example, has recently come out with a document that has got a tremendous amount of interest at the federal and at the provincial level. It's a document called Sustainability Within a Generation. And what we're saying is we've got to stop this battling over immediate issues of, you know, you got to stop clear-cutting this forest, or you can't build this dam, or you got to stop pollution. Of course, these are all things that we've got to consider. But we need a vision of where the hell are we going? So much of what we do today is just kind of, oh, we got a problem here, let's put a Band-Aid on it here, and let's fix this up over here. Nobody ever asks, what are we going for? Where do we want to go in 30 or 40 years? So what we've said is, let's get a vision of what we want Canada to be in 30 years. And it's clear everybody agrees. We want a country in which you can drink from any river or stream. We want a country where the air is clean and children don't suffer epidemic levels of asthma. We want a country where you can eat the fish anywhere you catch them and not worry about what's in them. So when you begin to flesh out what everybody wants, there's complete agreement. Yes, that's what we think Canada should be. So then you say, okay, let's let that be our target, our goal. We're not going to talk about doing it in a year or 5 years. We're talking about let's try to work towards that in 30 years. That means then whenever a company is adopting a new policy or going to produce a new product, whenever a government is talking about new regulations or new laws, the first thing you ask is, wait a minute now, what does that do in terms of our getting to that target? Is that going to improve or is it going to get us away from meeting that target? So once you've got a target, you've got a direction to go in. And everything can be weighed against whether or not it gets you closer or further away from that goal. And that's resonated very, very strongly. We got to meet the Prime Minister for an hour. We showed it to him, and already I hear him on radio, and he's saying, yes, we've got to think about a generation from now, and where do we think Canada will be? And he's beginning to use our terminology because he's kind of lifted his vision up there. And companies, when you stop hammering them and saying, you've got to do this right now, and you start saying, look, we've got to work towards a 30-year plan, they find that much easier to work towards because it's not an immediate disruption of the bottom line. So I'm very excited about this idea that we, and I hope in the United States, the states and cities and your federal government will begin to start thinking longer term about where you're going. Where is this country headed? What are the kind of values that you want to see in a generation from now? And then let's get on with meeting that.
So it's inspiring that Canada is now leading by example. And a lot of the examples that you bring in your book are from all over the world. And I see a lot of them come from the United States and even the Pacific Northwest.
Pacific Northwest is a very, very special place, I think, and very inspiring. I was just in Portland and I was telling the people there that you see the repercussions of Governor Tom McCall, who was in office in the 70s, who realized that, you know, they stop at the ocean. There's no more Oregon that stretches on beyond the ocean. Back in the 70s, they were saying to the public across the country, come and visit us. We're a beautiful state, but please don't stay. Go back home where you belong. That was a very radical thing for them to say. Governor McCall said, look, we can't grow indefinitely. We've got to put a boundary around our cities, and we've got to say you've got to stay within those boundaries because we can't keep using farmland and forests and destroying the environment just to keep growing indefinitely. Now, we've done a number of programs on the nature of things about urban sprawl, and every time we say, let's do another show on urban sprawl, first place we go is Portland because Portland is seeing the benefits of Governor McCall's decisions back in the 70s. No growth. And what you find is that Portland itself is a city that is a livable city because it's possible to live downtown, to play downtown, to work downtown, and you have far less dependence on the car. And it was very striking to me yesterday coming in from the airport from SeaTac. You know, you realize, my God, there is so much of the city now being put over to serve the car. There's got to be a better way to live in this beautiful part of North America. Seattle ought to be a place where you don't need the car to go and shop and work and all of that. We've got to have a smarter way of living. You can't just keep sprawling out to the suburbs. And I think because in the Northwest people come here, we're not the center of the universe the way New Yorkers think they are. We're not L.A., but we think this is a very special part of the world, and we like the out-of-doors, we like the climate, we like the wilderness. And I think because of that, it really shaped a lot of our attitudes, and you see a much greater progressiveness in terms of the environment up here than you do in the rest of the country.
So using the car as an example, how do we break through the current mode of thinking? Again, in your book, you mentioned the glue that holds the current mode together is a combination of the media, advertising, and politics.
Well, it's a difficult thing, especially coming down to the United States. I see the enormity of the problem that we face. The automobile has been subsidized now for almost 100 years. Massively subsidized. We, the public, are paying for all of the highways and the roads and the infrastructure of the firefighters and the ambulances and the hospitals and all of that. We're subsidizing in large part to serve the automobile. And it's very, very difficult then if we say, look, we've got to use public transit much more because it's far less polluting and one bus will take the passengers that occupy all of the cars that fill one city block. You know, you could put all those people in one vehicle, a bus. And coming in from SeaTac, again, I was looking at the cars. I think you have a, we call it an HOV lane, a high occupancy vehicle lane. We consider high occupancy two people in the car. And believe it or not, in Canada, when you get into an HOV lane, there are no other cars there. All the other cars have got one person on them, and they're jamming the highway. And you think, this is crazy, because most of us are going towards the same place. So we've got to get out of the habit. And of course, in America, the car is like the gun. People feel they have a sacred right to have their car. And coming down here, I feel like I'm on a different planet, because I hear people moaning and groaning about the fact that the price of gasoline is going so high. What is it here in Seattle now? What do you pay for a gallon?
Yeah, it's just topping $2 a gallon.
Well, I just can't believe it. We've been paying over $4 a gallon in Canada now for several years, and recently it's gone up by about 15 cents. You don't hear Canadians bitching about this. Go to England, it's $5 a gallon. Mind you, it's an imperial gallon, but nevertheless, the fact is that in the United States, we're living in la-la land if you think that the price of gas is outrageous. Do you know that the North American automobile fleet, and we're now talking about Canada as well as the United States, the average mileage that the North American fleet gets is exactly the same as the mileage a Model A Ford got in 1929. Now, we ought to be ashamed if that's the best we can do after 75 years is to have the same mileage as a Model A. Well, why is that? Because, of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger has 8 Hummers, because half of the fleet now is sports utility vehicles. Sports utility vehicles are being sold by false advertising. If you look at television and you see an ad for an SUV, do you ever see an SUV stuck in traffic in a city? They're always out in the country going through creeks and up dirt roads, and it's false advertising. 99% of the time, SUVs are stuck in traffic in big cities. But this is what we've got to now begin to change. And I see how difficult that is, because one year we decided to do a show on asthma. Asthma is in epidemic proportions in North America now. You can't go into a school class and not find kids with puffers. I grew up as a kid in the 1930s. My parents had never heard the word asthma. Nobody had asthma back in the 30s. It was a rare, rare disease. But today, it's in epidemic proportions. So we decided to do a program on asthma, and we said, we'll wait till there's a smog alert issued by the government in Toronto. When that happens, we'll take a crew down and film at the emergency ward of the Toronto General. Sure enough, there are a lot of smog alert days in Toronto. The announcement came, stay in today, the smog alert. So down we rush, and it was jammed. The emergency ward was jammed with old people and young people having asthma attacks. But what struck me was this. Many of the people were driven up by their children or their parents. They were worried sick. They come rushing in. You just see they're terrified that something might happen to their loved ones. And yet many of them drove up in a sports utility vehicle. And you realize, oh my God, we haven't put it together. Here they're worried about the life-threatening situation with their parents or their children. And yet they're driving a vehicle that is a major contributor to the cause of their crisis. So the problem is that we live in a world in which we don't see how everything is connected, that our lifestyle, our consumptive habits, our demand for bigger cars, our use of a lot of energy is creating problems that we then have to deal with. We've got to rethink the way we live in the world, that we're connected to everything else. We affect the air, the water, the soil by the way we act. We've got to begin to make changes in our lives. That's why a few years ago, my foundation teamed up with the Union of Concerned Scientists. These are American scientists in Boston. And we said, look, we want to give people a concrete idea of things that we can do to lighten our impact on nature. Where do ordinary people have the greatest impact on the natural world through the way that we live? And we found very quickly there are 3 areas. It's what you eat, it's where you live, and it's how you move. So food, housing, and transportation. Those are the 3 areas where each of us affects the natural world. And looking at those 3 areas, we came up with 10 simple suggestions about the most effective ways we can lighten our impact on nature. And I'll be honest with you, when they first came to me with the 10 things, I looked at the list and I said, get serious, this is trivial. Because I thought you had to sell your house and go live in a cave or something, you know, and wear a sackcloth. And to my amazement, the most effective things are really easy. You want me to give you a couple of examples?
Please.
In the area of food, we say try to eat without meat one day a week. Now, if you're a Catholic, you know, they used to do that all the time. They had a meatless day. And you don't have to suffer. You can eat comfort foods, you know, Kraft dinners and all kinds of things, and you can have good food. And you say, well, why does that make a difference? Well, as you know, it takes about 10 pounds of grain, which is perfectly edible, to grow 1 pound of meat. So you reduce your impact on the use of food lower down in the food chain. But the big thing is meat is a very ecologically expensive food. It takes about 85 times as much water to grow one serving of meat as it does to grow one serving of potatoes. So by reducing your diet to vegetables, you save on water, you save on air, you save on soil. So that's a very effective way, and it's hardly a sacrifice. We say in the area of transportation, if you take a car back and forth to work every day, try to give up the car one day a week. So that means take a bus or carpool or hitchhike or walk or whatever. But just give up the car for a routine practice one day a week. Well, that's not very difficult. And for your housing, we say try to insulate your home. Plug those holes that you leak air out of and try to save your energy bill by 10% by being more insulated. And so you're going to make money. Cut your energy bill by 10%. There are a lot of simple things. We say if you're buying a household appliance, try to get the most energy-efficient appliance. There are now hot water tanks, for example, that save 50% of your energy. There are refrigerators that are 80% more efficient than the old ones. So go for the most energy-efficient ones, and you're going to make money doing it. So these are very, very simple steps, but when you add them all up, it turns out that if a lot of people do this, it's a very effective way. We've called this the Nature Challenge. And if you go to our website, I think even in America, you can find our website at davidsuzuki.org. On the first page that comes up, you'll see the Nature Challenge. We have a Nature Challenge for kids. We're trying to show kids that they can do something. We have a Nature Challenge for business. And we're trying to get 1 million Canadians to voluntarily agree. Not to do all 10, but just to do at least 3 out of the 10 in the coming year. We've got 100,000 households now. Each household is about 3 people, so 300,000. We want to get 1 million. We've got something like 40 or 50 mayors of cities and towns. We've got entire city councils of Vancouver and Halifax. We've got 2 premiers of provinces. And I talked to the prime minister, and he says he'll sign it. So what we would like to do is get a grassroots movement that will become a political movement. If we can get enough people to sign on, every politician will have to say, hey, this makes a lot of sense. We're going to save money, and we're going to protect the environment.
Talk a bit, if you would, about your book is just filled with tons of examples
yes.
of different ways that people and groups are making significant changes. Could you tell us about some of them that really stick out in your mind?
Yes. Judy Wicks is probably one of the most inspiring people, and I've seen her go into a group of hard-nosed business people, you know, whose bottom line is how much profit am I making, and move them to tears. She's an amazing person. Lives in Philadelphia. She's a single mom, and she was looking around trying to find a way to make a living to be able to afford to feed, clothe, and educate her children, and started a restaurant called the White Dog Cafe. It's a locally based restaurant. She decided right away that we've got to try to support our local farmers, get as much of our meat and produce as possible from locally grown food. And she decided that it's going to be organic. Well, over time, she served good, nutritious food, and she now does about $5 million worth of business a year. Her employees, from the chief cook all the way down to the people that clean up afterwards, get way beyond minimum wages. She tries to pay them top dollar. She herself, as the person that started the restaurant, takes $70,000 a year as her income. And her chef, her top chef, gets exactly the same amount because she believes, she says, look, I've got more than I need. My children are all in university now. Soon they'll be gone out of the nest and I'm going to need less money. So what more do I need the money for? I want to use that to make sure that I hire people who are paid well. I want to turn whatever extra money I've got back into the community. She leads groups to go to the third world to show them the problems of raising food in the third world. She has regular lecture series to talk about food and why organic is better and why locally grown food is better. She has programs to bring kids in from the black communities to show them about cooking and restauranting, to try to train them so that they can go out and find jobs. So here's a person. I'm sure she could have franchised White Dog Cafe and, you know, had it all across the country, but who feels that she is able to make a decent wage and a living and wants to return back benefits to the community and be a part of that community. It's a very inspiring story. The battles that I've waged in British Columbia for 40 years have been with the logging community. And we're told over and over again, listen, you enviros, you tree huggers, we've got to compete in a global economy. And in a global economy, we have to be efficient. We have to bring in feller bunchers that replace men because that's the only way we can compete. We have to clear cut areas because to selectively log is just impractical. We've got to compete with Malaysia and Japan, and that's the only way to do it. Well, then we come down here to the Pacific Northwest and we see Collins Pine. This is a family-owned business, been in existence 150 years. They're not a mom-and-pop business. They do $250 million worth of business a year. And guess what? Their forests are considered by Oregon and Washington to be among the richest forests in the states. Even though they've been logged steadily for 150 years, they've still got spotted owls and wolves and bears in them. And if you walk in Collins Pines woods, you'd never know they'd been logged. They only selectively log. And hey, they're doing $250 million worth of business. That sounds pretty good to me. They employ thousands of people. They are plugged into their local community. They return a lot of their profits back into the local communities, and they're flourishing. Now, they admit right from the start they don't make as much profit in the short run as the companies that come in and clear cut and then take off, because they're in it for the long run and they've been at it 150 years. How many companies in Washington or Oregon have been around for 150 years logging your forest? There ain't none. Collins Pine stands as a shining example. It can be done right, and you can have your cake and eat it. They can log forever, as long as you maintain the integrity of the forest. And as long as you cut within the capacity of that forest to regenerate itself, you can do it forever. That's ecological sense, and that makes economic sense in the long run.
What can we as citizens do to be catalysts towards encouraging our government and corporations to make this jump?
One of the things that we did in the book is we cite the protests in Seattle as one of the good news stories. Now, there are a lot of people that are outraged by that and say, how dare you talk about all of those hooligans that were smashing stores in downtown Seattle and creating all this problem? Well, I was at Seattle, and I gave two talks. And guess what, folks? They weren't anywhere on the television screens. I talked at a huge convention center where there were, I think, 5,000 or 10,000 people present. And those people sat listening to talks from 8 o'clock in the morning until late at night. They were involved in educating themselves about what globalization was, and they were informed about why it's creating problems for third world countries, for workers and trade unions. But you see none of that, because what makes the news are a small bunch of kids that are down there raising cane and throwing rocks through windows. The reality is that what the tremendous movement, the anti-WTO and globalization movement, has done is raised the issue that a small number of people who are in the WTO, the World Trade Organization, these are not elected people. They are not accountable to anybody. This is not democratic. That behind closed doors, this small group of people is making major decisions that affect the lives and livelihood of millions of people around the world. And what the protesters were saying is, open the bloody door and let some light in. Let us find out why you're making these decisions, what you're doing it, and why you aren't listening to us. We've got some concerns as well. And I think that's a very healthy process. We talk about democratization. The United States is involved in a very difficult challenge of trying to democratize Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, we've got to democratize the World Trade Organization as well, the IMF and the World Bank. These are all groups that have huge impacts on our lives. And I see that as a very concrete thing, that hundreds of thousands of people are taking to the streets to demand that they be heard. So I think that's a good news story. Now, to get to a company, though, I recently heard a company that the CEO of a company that's featured prominently in the book. His name is Ray Anderson, and he started a carpet company called Interface. They make carpet tiles, and over 30 years, he built that company up to the largest carpet company in the world. They do $1 billion worth of business a year. In 1994, his salespeople came to him and said, "Ray, what is Interface's environmental policy?" And he said, "What are you asking me that for?" And they said, "Because the public, our customers, when we go in to try to sell them our carpets, they're asking us, well, what is Interface's environmental policy? What are you doing to protect the environment?" And Ray says, very honestly, "I didn't know a damn thing about the environment, and I didn't care. And my sales force came to me because it was the public, the customers, that were demanding to know whether we had a policy." So his workers came and said, "We would like you to address the company and tell us what you think our environmental attitude should be." And he says he was terrified because he didn't know a damn thing about it. He didn't know what to say. And just at that moment, a book came on his desk. It was a book written by a former company president called Paul Hawken. And Paul had written a book called The Ecology of Commerce. And so Ray grabbed the book and gratefully began to read it. And he said his heart sank as he read through the pages because he realized that his company was in the business of destroying the earth. And about halfway through, he said, "I felt as if someone had thrown a spear through my chest." And he said, "I began to weep at what I was doing and the business I was in." And that for him was his epiphany. He realized that he had to change. And he gave what must have been one hell of a speech to his company. And he said, "I charged my employees with developing policies and practices that reflected our concern for the state of the earth. I wanted a company that had no impact, a negative impact on the air, the water, or the other creatures that share the planet with us." He says they're about halfway there. Let me give you a simple example of what he did. At one point, he said to his engineers, the people that design their product, he said, "I want you to take a day off, and I want you to go into that forest. Just spend a day kicking around, see what you can learn from nature." So you got to imagine these people with engineering degrees and designing degrees, they're going out there and going, "What the hell has Ray got us kicking around the forest for?" You know, like they had no clue. But gradually, they began to look around. It was in the fall. And as they looked at the forest floor, they realized everywhere they looked in nature, you never see the same thing repeated over and over. It's always different. Those leaves and the shape and the way they fall on the floor, everything is different. So they came out of that day saying, "I wonder if we could imitate nature and design a product where nothing is the same. Every single tile has a unique pattern on it." So Ray thought it over and said, "You know, that's a good idea. Why don't we develop a line of tiles and see how it does?" Well, that tile, it became 5 times more popular than any other line of tiles they've ever had. They also said, "Well, you know, in nature, when one animal poops on the forest floor, immediately bugs jump on it and eat it. So one organism's waste is another organism's opportunity. Humans come along and they say, well, we'll just dig this stuff out of the ground, we'll make this product, we'll use the product. When we're done with it, we'll dump it back into the ground as waste. We're the only species that has a linear approach to things, dig it up and throw it away." And what they said is there a way of imitating nature by recycling everything so there's no waste at the end? And as a businessman, Ray said, "Hey, that makes a lot of sense. When we put money into manufacturing a tile, at the end of it, there's all the stuff that we have to throw away. That's waste. By definition, you can't sell it because it's waste. Nobody wants it. But we've paid money to develop waste. So when you take waste and put it in the dump, you're throwing money away. If we can find a way to develop a system where everything goes back into the hopper and there's no such thing as waste, we're going to make more money. So guess what? Now what they do primarily is they rent their carpets to big companies. They don't sell them. So that at the end of the life of that carpet, you just call Interface and say, okay, we want a new carpet. Come and take the old one. They come in, they tear the whole thing up, they pull it apart and put it back in the hopper, and none of it goes into the landfill. It's just reused. So it becomes what is the end product now becomes the raw materials for the new product at the other end of the stage. And so they've got complete recycling. And the point that's exciting about this is it's good business. His company is getting more of the market share, even though right now the economy is not in good shape. His company is doing better than most other carpet companies, and he's got more of the market share. So he's making huge amounts of money by doing the right thing. And he says he's only halfway there.
How do people find out more about your foundation?
Please go to our website, www.davidsuzuki.org. I'm very pleased with the website. We get a lot of traffic through there, and it's filled with suggestions about what ordinary people can do, what children can do. There are videos that you can connect with, and you can learn about the projects that we have. We've got forestry, fisheries, climate change projects, and there's lots of instructions. There's all kinds of instructions to empower people, because we really believe, in the end, the change is going to happen when lots of ordinary people say, this is what we have to do, and I'm going to put my life into making some of these changes. So through a lot of people being empowered, I think we can bring about any kind of change we want.
Well, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
We've just been talking with David Suzuki. He is co-author of Good News for a Change, How Everyday People Are Helping the Planet.